Okay, we're beginning here on the top of Nun Zayin Amud Aleph, seven lines down. Kiata Rabdimi, Amar Rabbi Shimon ben Pazi, Amar Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi, Mishum Bar Kapara, Machloket Bitchila. The Machloket is in the beginning, Abal Basof, the Divrei Akol. Whereas at the end, everybody agrees, Eina Mochelet. She's unable to be Mochelet. Rabbi Yochanan Amar, Ben Bezo, Machloket. In either case, it is still a machloket. So now, obviously, a lot of this is cryptic because, first of all, we don't know what the reference is to. That turns out to be a machloket. Rashi over here suggests that we're speaking about the machloket between Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Yossi. In yesterday's daf, we saw that there is a machloket in the ability of the woman to be mochelet on her ketubah. Rabbi Yossi says that she has that ability whether she does it in a written form or in a verbal and oral form, she's able to be mochelet on her ketubah. On the other hand, Rabbi Yehuda said that you can only do it hitkatavti, when she writes hitkabalti, when she says that I received it and writes a receipt for the monies that she was supposed to get through her ketubah. So there they had a machloket whether it works orally or does it only work in a written form. So Rashi claims that this is the machloket that they're discussing here, that Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi and Rabbi Yochanan are arguing about that issue. There are others who would say that this is about the machloket between Rabbi Meir and Rabbi Yehuda. The machloket that we saw yesterday between Rabbi Meir and Rabbi Yehuda, which is, are you allowed to build in conditions into things, first of all, Dover Sheba Mamon, things that are monetary matters. Are you allowed to make tnaim? Are you allowed to make conditions? Even, quote-unquote, keneged ha-Torah? So that's the machloket that they're discussing. Or, again, in our case here, the ability to forgive a portion of the ketubah. So those are the two possibilities as to what the machloket is. Then the Gemara itself now will discuss what they just mentioned. They mentioned tchila and sof, and they don't define what they're talking about in terms of tchila and sof, and that the Gemara will do right now. First of all, we have Amar Rabbi Yobo. The Didi Mefarshili Mina de Rabbi Yochanan. I was explained the words of Rabbi Yochanan. And Rabbi Yochanan said, Ana Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi, lo palginin adodi. I and Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi do not argue on each other. My bitchila. So what is the definition of the word tchila de kama Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi? Tchilat chupa. That's the beginning of the chupa. My sof. What is the end that he mentions over there? Sof bi'ah. That's all the way at the end or post bi'ah. So the definition of tchila and sof for Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi, looking at the continuum of nisuin, tchila is basically before the nisuin gets off the ground, and then sof is after nisuin are consummated completely. You're having that process of nisuin chupa and bi'ah. Chupa, taking the woman into his house. Bi'ah, which is the physical intimacy between them. So he says that tchila means prior to all of that, and sof means after all of that. B'chika mina ano, when I spoke, Rabbi Yochanan says, ben bezo machloket, when I said that, tchilat chupa, visof chupa. I spoke about the beginning of the chupa, and the end of the chupa, dehi tchilat bi'ah. And sof chupa is equal to tchilat bi'ah. So obviously the crossover between chupa and bi'ah, if you're at the end of chupa, you're at the beginning of bi'ah. So those are synonymous. So now the suggestion will go with Rashi's interpretation here, that this is a machloket Rabbi Yossi and Rabbi Yehuda. So what the suggestion is in Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi's statement, which is machloket bitchila, that Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Yossi disagree bitchila, tchila being tchilat chupa. Before the nisuin is done, there they have a machloket whether you're able to accomplish the reduction in the ketubah only through a written form, or can you also do it orally? Aval basof, sof here, according to Yeshua and Levi, means after the consummation of the chupah and the bi'ah, the divrei akol eina mochelet. After that point in time, she cannot be mochelet afterwards because it's already done. To forgive something after the fact doesn't help because you've already created the kinyanim, you've already created the smichut adat of this woman that she is going to get this. You can't then all of a sudden insert a tenai, a condition, after the fact. Conditions have to be there prior to the consummation. And therefore, afterwards, it's like trying to unwind an agreement that was already put in place. And that you do not have the ability to do. On the other hand, when Rabbi Yochanan spoke, he said, ben bezo machloket. He meant, tchilat chupa, which is similar to Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi, which means before the chupa, before the nisuim is accomplished, there they disagree as to whether you can affect the tanai, or effectuate the tanai. And then besof he meant was, sof chupa, tchilat bia. So it was that interim stage. In that interim stage, he also says there's still a machloket. If you accomplish chupa already, but you have yet to do bia, then this machloket still stands. You haven't reached the point of no return yet. The point of no return is only after bi'ah or post-bi'ah. And in doing so, Rabbi Yochanan now reconciles between himself and Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi to suggest that there is no machloket here between them. There are three stages here. One stage is prior to chuppah, next stage is between chuppah and bi'ah, and the final stage is after bi'ah. As far as after bi'ah, after the consummation of everything, everybody agrees, eina mochelet, it doesn't work. Before chupa and after chupa, Rabbi Yossi and Rabbi Yehuda have their machloket as to whether an oral condition will be effective in reducing the ketubah, with Rabbi Yossi saying yes and Rabbi Yehuda saying no. Whereas after everything is done, there everybody agrees she cannot be mochelet orally, she can only be mochelet in a written form. So after the fact, when we're talking about post everything that takes place, then orally, you cannot work the michila. For Rabbi Yehuda, it never works. For Rabbi Yossi, you also can't work it then because you're trying to insert a condition after the closing. You can't do that. Now, in terms of writing it, you can still do it because writing it is just a receipt that says that I received the money, even though I didn't receive it, but I received the money. You can write that receipt day one, or you can write that receipt 2 years, 3 years later. So it doesn't matter if it's before or afterwards. Everybody's going to agree in that case that you can give a receipt or a written receipt in order to reduce the ketubah. So that's the first version of this. Now we have a second version of this same machloka between them with a slight nuances in the differences in their opinions, which is Kiata Rabin. So here first we had Rav Dimi. Rav Dimi and Rabin travel to Eretz Yisrael and come back to Bavel, and numerous times they bring back Memrot from Eretz Yisrael. So over here we have Rav Dimi coming back with a Memra from Rabbi Yoshua ben Levi, and then we had Rabbi Yochanan's position, and then Rabbi Bou explaining Rabbi Yochanan's position based on what he heard from Rabbi Yochanan. Now we have Rabin bringing an alternate version of this machloket between them, which is Kiata Rabin. Amar Rabbi Yeshua ben Pazi, Amar Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi, Mishum Bar Kapara. Machloket libasof. There's a machloket in the end. Aval betchila, divrei hakol mochelet. In the beginning, everyone agrees that she can be mochelet. Rabbi Yochanan Amar ben bezo machloket. Doesn't matter. There's a machloket in both of these instances. Again, Rabbi Yabo makes his statement. Amar Rabbi Yabo, lididi mefarshili mine de Rabbi Yochanan. I heard, or I was explained this opinion of Rabbi Yochanan. Da'ana v'Rabbi Yoshua ben Levi lo palginan ahadodi. I and Rabbi Yoshua ben Levi do not argue on each other. Ma'ilu besof da'amai Rabbi Yoshua ben Levi. When Rabbi Yoshua ben Levi said besof, what was sof? Sof chupa. That was the end of the chupa. Ma'i tchila. What was the tchila over there? Tchilat chupa. That was before the chupa. V'chi gamina ano. When I said ben bazo machloket, I meant tchilat bia v'sof bia. I meant before the bia and after the bi'ah. So in this case, what you have here is a shift in where everybody agrees. In the second version, or the version that Rabin brings, in that instance, Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi says, in the case that they don't argue on each other, that was in the beginning. It says there, divrei hakol mochelet. That means prior. Prior to what? He says tchila now means tchilat chupa. Before you go down the path of nisuin, before you've gone into chupa or bi'ah, Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi says you can make an oral condition. That means both according to Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Yossi, you can make an oral condition and it will work. that's nigh will work. Because here you are before you're engaging in the process of nisuin whatsoever. Since you're prior to that, even Rabbi Yehuda agrees that an oral tanai will be enough to alter the value of the ketubah in the back end. Whereas, if we pass already chuppah, but we have yet to get into bi'ah, there we have a machloket. According to Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi, that's called sof. That was sof chuppah. According to Rabbi Yochanan, that's called chilat bi'ah. At that point, Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi and Rabbi Yochanan agree there's a machloket. Rabbi Yossi and Rabbi Yehuda argue as to whether that oral condition will be sufficient in order to undermine the ketubah, or do I need a written receipt in order to undermine the ketubah? That's their machloket. Then Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi does not address, which is after bi'ah, after you've completed the whole process of nisuin, Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi doesn't address that situation, but Rabbi Yochanan does, and he says sof means sof bi'ah. And there he says the machloket still stands. So even after bi'ah, they still have a machloket as to whether the oral tanai will be effective or not be effective. Rabbi Yossi is saying yes, and Rabbi Yehuda is saying no. So basically, between the two lashonot, the question is, where do we have agreement? In the first lashon, the lashon brought by Rabbi Dimi, the agreement is after everything is done. After the nisuin is completed, everyone agrees that over there you cannot use an oral condition. You can only use a written condition. Prior to that point, their machloket exists. That means either prior to bi'ah or prior to chuppah, either one of those, the machloket between them stands. On the other hand, in Ravin's version of this, their agreement is in the front end. The agreement is prior to nisuin, everyone agrees that you can effectuate a reduction in the ketubah through an oral condition, through a tanai. Their machloket then persists both after chuppah and even after bi'ah. They still have a machloket whether you can still use that oral condition to reduce the ketubah, or can you only use a written condition, which would be the position of Rabbi Yehuda. So that is the two versions of what we just saw here. And again, Rabbi Bo coming and reconciling between Rabbi Yehoshua ben Levi and Rabbi Yochanan to say that they're really not arguing, but they're really just speaking about different points in time. And by doing that, we have no machloket between Rabbi Yehoshua ben Levi and Rabbi Yochanan. They completely agree. It's just a question of what point on the continuum that they are addressing. Now that's according to Rashi's version that we're speaking about here, Rabbi Yossi and Rabbi Yehuda. Obviously, if we're speaking about Rabbi Meir and Rabbi Yehuda, then the question becomes about the ability, according to Rabbi Meir, to insert a tanai. According to Rabbi Yehuda, you can always insert a condition. According to the first version, that will be true until after the point of nisuin. At that point, inserting a condition seems meaningless because you're after the fact. So therefore, you cannot insert the condition at that point in time. Whereas Rabbi Meir will say that you can never insert the condition. In the second lashon, then there is agreement that before you start down the process of nisuin, you can stipulate conditions prior to that point in time. Before you begin the process of the ketubah, you can agree to whatever you want to agree beforehand, and that'll be fine. After that point, their machloket will persist. That's whether you are in the middle of that process of nisuin or the closure of that process of nisuin, their machloket will persist. Again, that depends on what you think the machloket is over here. And in those cases, again, the ability or the effectiveness of a tanai is being questioned between Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Meir. There are alternate gersot here as well, which make it much more complex, but just know that it's not clear because the Gemara never really defines who they're speaking about. What is the reference point for the machloket over here? And that's what leaves it open, because all they tell you is tchila and sof machloket. They just never tell you what are the positions behind what they are suggesting over here, or the reasons behind those positions. Right, so now the Gemara continues and says, Amar Papa, Ilav Damar Rabbi Abau, Ledidi Mefarshale Mine de Rabbi Yochanan, Da'ana of Rabbi Yehoshua ben Levi lo Palgina, Dodi. Papa says, had it not been for Rabbi Abau coming along and saying that I heard from Rabbi Yochanan that Rabbi Yochanan and Rabbi Yehoshua ben Levi do not argue, where Rabbi Yochanan says about himself, I and Rabbi Yehoshua ben Levi do not argue, Havamina, I would have thought, Rabbi Yochanan, Rabbi Yehoshua ben Levi, plige. I would have thought that they actually do argue. And Rav Dimi v'Ravin, lo plige. And Rav Dimi and Ravin are not arguing over here. My sof dikama Ravin. Because what is the sof that Ravin mentions? Sof chupa. Umay tchila d'amar Rav Dimi, and the tchila that Rav Dimi speaks about is tchilat biya. Because sof chupa and tchilat biya are synonymous, and therefore they don't argue. Mar wants to know, my kamashmalan, what is that coming to teach us? Because Rav Papa is making a theoretical statement. He's making a statement that had we not had Rabbi Bo's interjection here, which suggested that Rabbi Yochanan and Rabbi Shuv ben Levi don't argue, then I would have said they do argue. Okay, probably makes a lot of sense. But then he reconciles between Rav Dimi and Ravin. Why is Rav Papa even mentioning this? Because we have Rabbi Abahu. And Rav Papa in the end is bound by Rabbi Abahu because Rabbi Abahu gives us information that seems to come directly from Rabbi Yochanan that there is no machloka between Rabbi Yochanan and Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi. So hakamash malan. What the conclusion from Rav Papa's statement is, de plige tre amurai ataima de nafshayu, velo plige tre amurai aliba de charamora. We would give precedence or preference to two amuraim arguing in svara, in their positions, rather than having two amuraim arguing within the single position of another amora. Basically, what Rav Papa is saying is, I'd rather have a machloket Rabbi Yochanan and Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi, because Rabbi Yochanan and Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi are arguing in svara. They're arguing about the logic of the positions that are there. This one has his position, this one has this position. On the other hand, Rav Dimi and Ravin, if you say they are arguing, then basically what you're saying is, one of them had the girsa this way, and one of them had the girsa that way. There's not a logical argument over here, there's simply an argument in misora. Who had the right misora? Who has the right version of the facts that are here? He's not saying it doesn't happen, but he's saying if you give me a choice between an argument in svara versus an argument in misora, I'll prefer an argument in svara over an argument in misora. Now Rashi says it in a much stronger fashion. It's so amazing what Rashi says over here because Rashi defines why that is the case. He says, "Dechi plige trei aliba dechad." One of them is lying. That's a very strong lashon. Tosafot uses the lashon of echad mehem ta'ah, which would be a nicer way of saying it. One of them has a mistaken misora, because they both can't be right. They both can't be true. One has a misora this way, one has a misora the other way. So Rashi says one of them is not telling the truth. Tosafot uses the term echad mehem ta'ah. Aval ki plige tri marai bedin o beisur beheter. If we have them arguing about a dinner, Yisra v'heter, Chochot amar chachi, mistaver taima, ein kan sheker. So if each one of them says, this is a better logical argument for me, or this makes more sense, neither one of them is lying. Kochad v'chad svar di dekamar. Because each one of them is presenting their position. And their position can be supported, and their position can be valid. Now, this is the amazing line of Rashi. V'ikala meimar, Elu ve'elu divrei elukim chayim heim. And in that instance, we can say they're both right. Both of them are the mesora. Both of them are correct. Now, why? Because zimnin d'shayach haitama. The zimnin d'shayach haitama. It says sometimes that position will be right. Sometimes the other position will be right. She'atam mitapech lefi shinui dvarim b'shinui ma'at. Because the reasoning or the logic can change on just a nuance in the situation or the circumstance. And therefore, sometimes this person will be right, and sometimes that person will be right. So Rashi makes two levels of argument here. One level of argument is, when I have a machloket about misora, clearly someone is wrong. And when I have a machloket in svara, when I have a machloket about logic or positions, then both of them can be right. That's the first stage that Rashi takes. In the case of misora, there's clearly a problematic position. In the case where we're dealing with a logical argument, elu ve'elu divrei elukim chayim. But then Rashi goes on to define what it means, elu ve'elu divrei elukim chayim, which is that, not that they are both right, but rather that each one of them can be right at certain times. There are circumstances where this one will be right, and there are circumstances where that one will be right, and therefore I can find a path that will give me the truth in both positions, not that they're simultaneously true, but that Elu Velu Divrei Elukim Chaim means this is different than the way other Rishonim view Elu Velu Divrei Elukim Chaim. Other Rishonim say that Torah is given into the hands of man, and therefore, if the Misora and the logical arguments bring people to these different positions, both of those positions are considered to be valid positions. We'll paskin like one decision because, again, it's in the hands of man. We can make that decision as to which position that we follow. But that does not invalidate the alternate position. Number one, in makom adchak, we might rely on the other position. That's number one. Number two is the Torah and the explanation of the other position is an equally valid position in the Torah. Now again, for practical purposes, for psak halacha, we have to come to a hachra'ah. We have to come to a decision to act on one of them and not the other. But the validity of each position is still there. Rashi over here defines elu elu divrei elukim chayim as being that each position has a time when it's manifest. And since each one has a time when it's a manifest, therefore they are real. Now, if they were mutually exclusive opinions, I don't know how Rashi would explain that, meaning that it's harder to argue in a case of mutually exclusive positions that you have elu ve'elu divrei elukim chayim, because they're not going to be manifest. They can't have them manifest here and there because they're mutually exclusive, and therefore it'd be much more difficult to explain it. So Tosafot raises your question, which is, all you've done is postpone the problem another generation. Rabbi Yochanan and Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi are arguing about the positions of Rabbi Yossi and Rabbi Yehuda, or Rabbi Meir and Rabbi Yehuda, depending on what you think the machlokas is here. They're arguing in someone else's position, and then all Rabin and Rabbi Vimi are doing is arguing in the position the next generation down about what were Rabbi Yochanan and Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi's positions. But Tosafot brings up your issue, and he says, "Zim Tomar, my nafkamina, da Hashanami, pliga Rabbi Yochanan and Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi, alibo de chatano." They're arguing in the position of one of the Tanaim. Now, the way that Rashi explained it over here is that the way that you would explain the machlok between Rabin and Rav Dimi is that they're arguing only in the position of Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi. Rabbi Yochanan, they would agree in his position. It's just within the position of Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi that they're arguing. So too over here, the case of Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi, Rabbi Yochanan, they're arguing, and according to one of these Tanaim, they disagree as to what their position would be in these circumstances. Says Yesh Lomar, "See, pligi Rabbi Yochanan, Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi, aliba dechatana lo chayshinan." We don't worry about that. "Desvarahu depligi velo tohu bishmuatam." He says there's a qualitative difference in the argument between Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi and Rabbi Yochanan versus Rav Dimi and Rabin. Rav Dimi and Rabin are simply bringing you a misora. They're not arguing as to the validity of Rabbi Yochanan and Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi's positions in certain circumstances. They're simply bringing over a misora what they heard. We heard this, and then they bring it to us. That is just bringing a shmua. On the other hand, Rabbi Yochanan and Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi, their argument is not about a misora as to what Rabbi Yossi and Rabbi Yehuda said. Their argument is a logical argument as to when Rabbi Yossi and Rabbi Yehuda would apply. And so therefore, they're using their own logic to determine when it makes sense to put the machloka here and when does it make sense to put the machloka there. And therefore, it's a different type of qualitative arguing within a position. So if Rav Dimi and Rabin were arguing about Rabbi Yeshua's position in a qualitative manner, which was, we think that Rabbi Yeshua makes sense to say that here and not there, then it would be the same. But that's not the case. Kiata Rav Dimi and Kiata Rabin, they're just saying, this is what we heard was the machloket. In that case, it's a machloket in Shmua, not a machloket in logic. As opposed to Rabbi Yochanan and Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi, they're not saying, I heard that that's where Rabbi Yossi applies. I heard that's where Rabbi Yehuda applies. They're saying, logically, I think this is where they should say this and where they shouldn't say that. And then it becomes the same difference that we discussed in Rashi before, that there is a difference between a logical argument versus a misora argument. All right, next Mishnah. Notim lebetula shtemasar chodesh mishitava abal. The betula gets 12 months from the time that the baal indicates to her that he's ready for nisuin in order to prepare herself. She gets together all the takshitin, the clothing, and anything else that she needs to bring into the marriage that she will take care of over that 12-month period. Just like we give the woman 12 months, we also give the man that ability of the 12 months to b'mfanes himself, which is the tzarchei tzuda and the chupa, to pay for the wedding and for the mizonot, and again to take care of the house and everything that he's going to have to provide for his new bride. Uli almana shloshim yom. For an almana, she only gets a 30-day window. Rashi over here says, sheino tarachat kol kach v'takshitim shvar yesh v'yada. The fact that she was already married means that she already has the jewelry, she already has much of what is needed in this preparation she already has in hand. That's number one. Number two is that there's less likelihood that someone's going to wait around for the almana. The bitula where we're talking about younger individuals, and again, a betulah, which is a more appealing, then they're going to wait, they're willing to wait around longer. By an amanah, they're going to be less likely to want to wait around, and therefore there's a 30-day window. What you don't have addressed here is, the amanah is 30 days. How does that affect the man side of this? Most of the Rishonim just read it, that it's based on the woman. Yes, there is a need for the man to prepare, but whatever the woman's window is, that's what the man is granted. So if a betulah is granted 12 months, the man gets 12 months. The almanah is granted 30 days. So too, whether it's an almon or a bachur that's marrying her, he only gets 30 days. He doesn't get any more window than what the woman is given. You obviously could argue otherwise, which is that the man also gets his time, which is he gets his 12 months to prepare. So for an almanah, yes, she gets 30 days, but he still gets his 12 months. So we'll be governed by him instead of by her there, which will be a longer window of time. All right, that's one issue. The second issue is, when does it get triggered? The Mishnah says, Mishatava Baal. When the Baal asks for her hand in marriage, this seemingly is different than Erusin or Kiddushin. These are two different stages. There's Erusin and Kiddushin. We've, until this point, basically said they're synonymous. We said from the time of Erusin, it's 12 months out, there is Nisuin. From this Mishnah, it seems that that is not the case. One is Erusin and Kiddushin. The second one is when the Baal says, let's go, it's time for us to get ready for the Nisuin. They might happen simultaneously. You could have the Baal have the Kiddushin and then say, now prepare yourself for Nisuin, so they could overlap. But there's also a possibility they could have Kiddushin, and then a month later he says, okay, let's get ready to get married. And the 12-month clock would only start from that latter period, not from the Erusin or the Kiddushin, based on the way the Mishnah is phrased. The Mishnah doesn't say from the point of Erusin, from the point of Kiddushin. It says simply from the time that the Baal asks for her hand in marriage. So again, it doesn't seem that that could precede the Erusin or Kiddushin. It would only be afterwards, but not clear. The Mishnah never clarifies that. What is the amount of time between Erusin and Kiddushin and Mishatava Baal? We'll see now that there might be long windows that could happen in certain circumstances. I'll see in the second half of today's daf. But clearly the Mishnah doesn't go the simple route of just saying Erusin and Kiddushin, which means that these are seemingly separate issues. Right? Higiyazman Veloniso. If he time comes and he doesn't marry her. So here he proposed to her, the 12-month window elapses, and now he's supposed to take her as a wife. He hasn't done that. Ochlot Mishalo. They can eat on his dime now, because now he's responsible for the woman. He starts having to feed her at this point. Vochlot bitruma. And if he is a Kohen, she's entitled then to eat from the truma. Rabbi Tarfon Omer, notlim la kola kol truma. Not only do you give her some chulin and some truma, you give her 100% truma. Rabbi Kiva Omer, mechsa chulin o mechsa truma. You give her 50% chulin, 50% truma. What they're arguing about is a woman cannot eat truma all the time. Because a woman has periods of time when she is tmeah. When she's in nidah, she's tmeah, and she may not partake in truma. So if you give her 100% truma, there are going to be times where she can't utilize the truma. So what she'll have to do is she'll have to sell the truma to a kohen, monetize that, and then buy chulin in order to eat during those periods of time that she is tmeah. So what Rabbi Tarfon says, that's right. She'll have to take on some of that responsibility to deal with the truma. On the other hand, Rabbi Akiva says, no, you give her 50% chulin, 50% truma. That way, when she's tmeah, she can utilize the chulin. When she is Torah, she can utilize the truma. Now, mina Torah, generally, it would be actually a 25% versus 75% difference. And nidah is only nidah for 7 days, mina Torah. So out of a monthly cycle, it would be about 25%. Nevertheless, Rabbi Akiva says that he gives a 50-50 split between truma and chulin, which is interesting in terms of the breakdown, instead of 25% or 75%, but obviously sometimes she become a zavag dola, could extend for longer periods of time, as well as the fact that a person can become tamei, not just from nida, but from other items. And therefore, he gives this 50-50 breakdown rather than 25-75. Now, a yavam enu machil bitruma. A yavam does not trigger this ability to eat bitruma. Asta shisha chodoshim bifnei abal. 6 months she waited while her husband was alive. And then 6 months she was waiting for the Yavam. Or, Vafilu Kulan Bifnei Abal, Chaser Yom Echad, Bifnei Yavam. Even if 100% of them were before the Baal except for one day, she got 12 months minus a day, her husband is alive. Her husband passes away a day before they're supposed to have Nisuin. And then the Yavam picks up over there that one day. O kulam b'fnei Yavam chaser yom echad b'fnei Abbas. Or the other way around. You have her husband passes away the day after start this clock for the 12 months. So the Yavam has the whole time except the one day before the Baal. Or the other way around. The Baal has all the days except for that one day that was before the Yavam. Eina ochelet b'truma. She is not entitled to eat truma. Zo mishnah rishonah. This was the original Mishnah. This is the original way that they conducted themselves. Now, this is for a number of reasons. Number one, which you need to know, is that the woman is really entitled to Truma from the day that the Erusin or the Kiddushin go into effect. And that is because the right of a Kohen to grant to his family members Truma is based on blood lineage, number one. Or number two is Kinyan Kaspo, people that he quote-unquote owns. So when he has an Eved Knani or Shivcha Knanit, they are Kinyan Kaspo, therefore they're entitled to eat Truma along with the Kohen. So the woman, in the case of Erusin and Kiddushin, is also deemed to be Kinyan Kaspo. And so because of that, she's really entitled to eat Truma from the time of Erusin, time of Kiddushin. The reason that we postpone it, we'll see in the Gemara. The Gemara will discuss why. But because of that, all of this postponement are Dinim or Takanot, Midrabanan, to postpone the eating of the Truma until the point of Nisuin, or the point of time he should have done Nisuin. According to the Mishnah Rishonah, once you cross over that threshold of when they should have done Nisuin, she becomes Muteret in Truma. She's now allowed to eat Truma. We go back to the original status of Erusin and Kiddushin, where she should have been entitled all the way back then. And now we say she gets Truma, she can eat Truma at this point in time. And if the husband has an obligation to feed her, that obligation can be fulfilled either through chulin or through truma if he is a kohen. That's number one. Number two is Rashi says over here, v'hu adin nami im nitchayev b'chayav. What happens if she does the entire 12 months in front of her husband, and now they're past the 12 month point, and she started to eat truma? Lo achla mishamet. She will not continue to eat after it passes away. The kinyan of baal paka, because the kinyan of the baal is now gone. But if they had gotten 100% of the 12 months in front of her husband, then she will eat truma. So for instance, if she crosses over the 12 month period and he has yet to get married to her, he starts to feed her truma. Her husband passes away before Nisuin, and now the Yavam picks up. What Rashi says is, she'll stop eating truma now. Truma's gone. Because the Kinyan Kaspo was her husband's Kinyan. That kinyan has been dissolved or dissipated in a sense, because the Yavam is now picking up, and she's not his kinyan kaspo, because the kinyan kaspo was done by her previous husband or the brother that did it originally. It's interesting, and it's somewhat difficult to say that, only because by Yibum we only have Nisuin. Why do you only have Nisuin by Yibum? Seemingly it's because the Kiddushin or Erusin of the first brother carries over to the Yavam. And so it seems that the kinyan kaspo would continue over. Now, the Rabbeinu Tam argues, the Rabbeinu Tam is not found here. It's actually found on the bottom of Nun Chet Amud Aleph. There's a Tosafot over there, where the Rabbeinu Tam says that he thinks Rashi is incorrect over here. And therefore, the Rabbeinu Tam says, Rabbeinu Tam Nira, Dr. Rasha, the Darish B'Gemara, Kinyan Kaspor, Marachmana, Vaha Kinyan Dachivu, Asmachta Ba'almahu. That which Rashi quotes, that the Kinyan Kaspor of the brother, and not the Yavam, that's simply an Asmachta. Dimidoraita Michal Achla. Because Minat Torah, she is entitled to eat even with the Yavam. Ulufi Mishnah Rishona, Heicha Da'achla B'chayei HaBaal, Ochelet Nami B'zichat HaYavam. And therefore, the Rabbeinu Tam believes, if she started to eat Truma under her husband's auspices, she will continue to eat Truma under the auspices of the Yavam. Now, the Rabbeinu Tam agrees that if she never started with her husband, then the Yavam cannot empower her to eat Truma. But he disagrees with Rashi in the Mishnah Rishona, and he says that if she already started to eat truma by her husband, she will continue to eat under the auspices of the Yavam. It will not stop. So the difference between the Rabbeinu Tam and the Rashi is, if you've started. According to Rashi, if you started, it still can be terminated. The husband passes away, the Yavam takes over, it's terminated. According to Rabbeinu Tam, is once you're in motion, you stay in motion. Which is that once you start to eat truma, you can't be stopped from eating truma. So if she started under the husband, then the Yavam will not stop that point. Nevertheless, if she has not eaten under the husband's auspices, then she cannot eat because of the Yavam. And he writes, V'hainu taima de Mishnah Rishonah, de shlo achla b'chay abal, ino ochelet, da'ika l'meichash l'simpon, l'shema tashkeh. So the other reasons that we're going to see in the Gemara as to why she's not entitled to Truma, those equally apply under the Yavam as they do to the Baal, and therefore she didn't get started, but she's not underway, then we will not continue eating mizonot of Truma. But once she has already started to eat Truma, that means that we've already solved some of these problems. If we've solved these problems, and that's why she's eating Truma now, that means that those problems are solved not only for the husband, but also for the Yavam. If that's the case, she should be able to continue to eat Truma. It's like a fundamental machlok between Rashi and Rabbeinu Tam as to whether once she's starting eat Truma, she can continue Aliba to the Mishnah Rishona. Now, according to Mishnah Rachona, it won't matter because she won't eat ever. Beit Din Shalachareyam Amru. The Beit Din that came afterwards says, Eina Yisha Ochele B'Truma Ashit Tikanes L'Chupa. They said it's definitive. Doesn't matter if we're over the threshold where she's entitled to Mizonot. If she crosses over that threshold, they will have to feed her chulin. She's not entitled to Truma until she is a Nisua. That's it. Point blank. There is no getting Truma before you are a Nisua. You're not a Nisua. Even though you crossed over that 12-month threshold, you'll get chulin. You will not get Truma. Okay. Menahane mile. How do we know that you wait 12 months for a bitula? So Gemara brings a hint to this. Amar of Chista, Damakra, the Pasuk says, Vayomer achia v'ima, teshev ha'nara itanu yamim o asor. So this is by the case of Rivka. This is where the Midrash is midayek out of the Pasuk that Betuel died during the period of time that Eliezer was there. And the Midrash comes up with the whole story. It creates a circumstantial situation as to why Betuel died over there, tried to poison Eliezer, and he himself drank it, got switched around, and he dies. How do they know that Betuel died? Because who is the one addressing Eved Abraham? In the beginning, Eved Abraham is being addressed by Betuel, by Rivka's father. Then all of a sudden here, when it comes to the negotiation about letting Rivka go, who's piping up? It's her brother and her mother. Why are her brother and her mother negotiating with the Eved Abraham? What happened to her father? So that's where the Midrash comes up with the fact that Betuel died that night and was eliminated from the situation. So in that case, the mother and brother, brother being Lavan, of Rivka are negotiating with Eved Abraham. And they say, let the Ne'ara, let this young girl stay with us. Yamim o Asor. So Asor means 10 of something. Yamim means a plural of something. The question is, what do they mean? So now, my Yamim. What is the meaning of the word Yamim? Ilema tre yome. If you say that it's 2 days, that would make sense. The minimum of a plurality is 2. So if I say Yamim, it means the plural of days. So that would mean a minimum of 2 days. So he says, Mishtai inish hochi? Do people really conduct themselves in this manner? Do they speak in such a manner? Amarle tre yome. They say to him, look, maybe she'll stay with us for 2 days. Amar lo lo. Eved Abraham answers back and says, no, I'm not leaving her for 2 days. So Amarle asara yome. Let her stay for 10 days. I mean, they ask for a lesser amount and he rejects it. So then they ask for more. That's not the way you negotiate, right? You negotiate from the larger number down to a smaller number. You don't start at the smaller number and then move up to a bigger number after they reject you. You go, all right, listen, she'll stay with us for a couple of days. No. All right, she's going to stay with us for 10 days. That makes no sense. I mean, some people negotiate that way. People will negotiate it that way, telling them that you better take the first offer because the offer's only going to get worse, not better. But in general, that's not the general approach that we take to negotiations. Elama yamim shana. Yamim means 1 year. Dichtiv yamim tiyeh gu'ulato. So here in Sefer Yikra, when it talks about the redemption of a house in a walled city, it says there, yamim tiyeh gu'ulato. You have a right of redemption for an entire year. That year is represented by the word yamim. So what the Gemara is saying is that the yamim also over here, by the case of Rivka, refers to a full year. What we would say is, yishev itanu yamim, let her stay with us for a year. If he rejects it, oh, asor means, now you could argue here it means 10 months or 10 days, more likely 10 months. Let her stay with us 12 months. Okay, no? Okay, let her stay with us for 10 months. So then they're going down in number. I mean, the negotiation is moving forward to negotiating the amount of time that we'll say. And then in the end, they call her in and ask her what she wants to do. She says she's ready to leave right now. So that was the end of that negotiation. So the Gemara says, V'eima chodesh. How do you know the word yamim really means a year? It could also mean a month. Tichtiv ad chodesh yamim. So in Bamidbar and Balotcha, when they eat the slav, it says that Hashem says they're going to eat this for a month of days. So over there, you also have days. Now you could argue that the pasuk means yamim means 30 days, and asor means 10 days. Let her stay with us for 30 days. It says, no, okay, let her stay with us for 10 days. Amrei, dani yamim stam, yamim stam. We are making a Gezeirah Shavah. This is for a definition. It's not like a real Gezeirah Shavah. But we're trying to define the word Yamim. We'll use another case where the word Yamim is used by itself without any qualification. V'indar min Yamim, stam mi Yamim shnei Rabban Chodesh. And we're not going to learn out the word Yamim here, which is stands by its alone, from a word Yamim, which is modified by Chodesh. Because the two are not the same. We're going to try to look for something that's more similar. When Yamim stands alone, that's more similar. In that case, it means a year. Amar Rabbi Zeira, Tano. This is going to undermine everything that we have said in the entire Yevamot and Ketubot until this point in time. Although it does make this situation more palatable for many of us, which is Amar Rabbi Zeira, Tano. Benhi, Benavia, Yecholim La'akev. When it comes to a young girl, whether it's her or whether it's her father, they have the ability to postpone the marriage. Now, the postponement of the marriage is how long? Some Rishonim believe over here, up to the 12-month period of the Nisuin, which is the normal window given. They both have the ability to push it out to the end of that 12-month period. On the other hand, most of the Rishonim believe, and that's the way Rashi explains over here, that means that she can indefinitely postpone it until she becomes a Gedola. That she has a right over here to postpone the marriage. Even if there was Kiddushin supposedly performed over here, nevertheless, she has a veto right that the Nisuin will not be consummated until after she is of age. Bishlama ihi matzim akva. Okay, the Gemara says, I understand why she can reject it, because in the end, she is the party to the marriage over here. So of course she should have a right of veto, because how can we force her into a marriage without her acquiescence? So now it's interesting because she is a ktana in this case, and we're giving her rights of refusal in a sense. Not necessarily to reject the marriage, but postpone the marriage. Why? Because number one, she's subject to two things. One is the biyah, which for a biyah for a ktana, the Gemara feels is very painful. So she has a right to reject that until she is of age and she can be sovelet. She can handle the biyah. And number two is she's going to have to work for her husband and take care of the things in the house. There are burdens that have to be taken care of when you're running a household. And those burdens are not simple, and therefore she has a right to reject it. Some of them quote the continuation of the pasuk from what we just spoke about before, which is in the end they said, Nishala Lepia, let us ask Rivka what she wants. So you see that they called in Rivka to make a decision in the end. Rivka had the final say in the matter. So same thing over here. The girl has the final say in the matter. So Gemara says, I understand why she has a veto right. Ela Avia, when it comes to her father, if she is willing and wants to get married now, why should her father have a right of veto at this point in time? What does the father have to lose at this point in time that he has a right of veto? Savar, hashta lo yadol machar. So she doesn't know what's coming to her. Meaning basically, she's young and blissful and doesn't realize what marriage really entails. And she's running into marriage because she thinks of it as being some glorious institution that she's going to enjoy and every day is going to be a party. Then all of a sudden she realizes that it's not. Mimarda, vinafka, va'atio. She's going to, quote unquote, rebel against her husband, leave him. Va'atio vinafla ilavai. And then she's going to come back to me and it's going to be my problem. Now what Rashi says over here, it's going to be my problem, is that I'm going to have to adorn her again, I'm going to have to dress her up again, I'm going to have to provide for her to get married in another situation. You could argue that she's going to come back to me, I'm going to have to support her, I'm going to have to take care of her. So there is a financial ramification to the fact that she might be entering the marriage too early. She might not have the visibility into understanding what the marriage entails. Therefore, the father has a right of refusal or a veto right, because in the end, he's going to be the one picking up the pieces if it doesn't work out. Tosafot over here speaks about the possibility of the loss of ketubah. Because later on in the Masechta, we're going to see about a quote-unquote rebellious wife, that they start to be pochet ketubata. They start to reduce her ketubah. So Tosafot speaks about that over here. He says that that won't necessarily happen because it's not her ketubah to collect. In the instance where she's a ketana, the ketubah is going to go back to the father, not to her. So then what Tosafot says is, Yeshomar, Davila in the memory, Garshena below ketubah. Shai ketubata la'av. He'll divorce her without a ketubah. She won't get a ketubah because the ketubah belongs to the father, not mimarda, which is that we're going to get a reduction in her ketubah. She doesn't get a ketubah anyway. So it's not about the mered necessarily that they're going to get a reduction in the ketubah. It's just the fact that she's going to leave this husband. She's going to get divorced. When she gets divorced, that's going to cause an issue for her father in terms of supporting her or in terms of providing for her a new marriage. Now, Amar Rabbi Ava Bar Levi, Ein puskim al haktana le'asiya kishiktana. You do not negotiate to bring a ktana to marry her while she's a ktana. Al puskim al haktana le'asiya kishikdola. You're allowed to arrange a shidduch when she is younger, in order to have that be consummated when she already is of age, that the nisuin will take place when she is of age. Now, Rashi reads this. Rashi makes a clear qualification over here. Rashi says, of a puskim, the davka below kiddushin. That's only if there's no kiddushin done. Rashi is mindful of the Gemara in Kiddushin. The Gemara in Kiddushin says that a father should not marry off his daughter. He should not accept kiddushin on behalf of his daughter until she is of age. Till she's of an age where she can look at the man and say, yeah, this is what I want, this is who I want to marry. That she should have some say in the matter. When she's a ktana, if the father accepts kiddushin, then she really doesn't have a lot of say in the matter because, number one, obviously the father's empowered to do this, but number two is she's just not old enough to understand or to make such a decision. So the Gemara in Kiddushin says, don't accept kiddushin for a ktana. Now, our Gemara does not say that. Number one is, the first statement of Rabbi Zera is, Ktana beni ben avia yecholim la'akev. The case of Akev over there is clear where Kiddushin was already done, and there being Akev, the Nisuin. So there was Kiddushin. So maybe they violated that and they did Kiddushin, it's not clear. The second statement over here doesn't mention Kiddushin at all. The question of what Ein Puskim means. Does Ein Puskim mean, do not accept Kiddushin for her to be married prior to her coming of age, but you may accept Kiddushin for her to be married later on? That you could easily read into the Gemara. Rashi doesn't want to do that because he's reconciling with the Gemara in Kiddushin, which says we do not accept Kiddushin for Ktana whatsoever. It's obvious that other Rishonim take different approaches. One approach is to say these sugyot argue. The Gemara in Kiddushin says you do not accept Kiddushin for Ktana. Our Gemara says you can accept Kiddushin for Ktana as long as the Nisuin is postponed till after she comes of age. So that's number one, which is maybe there is a machloke between the Gemara here in Ketubot and the Gemara in Kiddushin. The other possible way to reconcile between them is to say that they're talking about in different circumstances. In the case in Kiddushin, it's her father marrying her off. When her father's marrying her off, that means that there's someone there to take care of her. In that case, we say, do not accept Kiddushin on her behalf, because the father is there. And as long as she's not married, the father will take care of her. So she has a guardian, which will protect her and take care of her. Therefore, just wait for the Kiddushin until she comes to age and she can make the decision. In the case here, it might be a case where we're talking about a ktana that does not have a father. And therefore, there isn't an obvious guardian for this girl. So there is a value in putting the kiddushin in place so that someone is responsible for this girl. Even though the nisuin will not be completed until she gets older, we still want to have the process in place by which there is someone looking out for the best interest of this young girl. So by accepting kiddushin, you can already get that process underway. Even though the nisuin will not happen until she grows older, nevertheless, this individual now has a vested interest in this girl being treated properly and being taken care of because he's going to marry her in the end. So that's another way to reconcile. It's clear that Rashi reconciled by simply saying, Puskim doesn't meet Kiddushin. Puskim is the negotiations. It's writing a shidduch. We have the terminology is used by Shabbat when you can be Posek for the Ktanim. You're allowed to, again there, it's shiduchin, or you can hire someone to teach the child Torah. You can negotiate that on Shabbat. There they use the term poskim. So poskim usually revolves around a monetary negotiation. And that might be what Rashi is referring to over here. These are the monetary negotiations that surround the marriage prior to the kiddushin. And then the kiddushin will be done when she gets older. Where it says, pshito. Of course. What do you mean? Why should you have a ktana get married before she is a gdola? Of course you should wait for the nisuin until afterwards. And of course, you can do kiddushin earlier because kiddushin don't affect the girl. The nisuin is what really affects her in her status and her position. Interesting that Gemara says pshita. We just had masechta and a half talking about issues of tanot getting married, tanot having biyah, all these sorts of things. And the Gemara here says pshita. It's very interesting. Gemara says maudatema, leichosh dilma, mailo pachada, mihashto v'chalsho. Maybe if we allow the kiddushin to take place now and the nisuin to take place later, according to those that think kiddushin, according to Rashi, the negotiation of the shidduch, even though the kiddushin haven't taken place, the anticipation of the marriage might cause her to fear, and that fear might weaken her constitution, and therefore she will grow up, mature in a way that is not positive. Whether that's from the mental standpoint, because she's always living with this fear in the back of her mind that she's getting married, Or is it from even a physical standpoint that she won't be able to physically grow and strengthen herself because she has this fear that is sitting in the back of her mind that she's going to get married? Kamash Malan, then we don't worry about such a fear. Again, according to Rashi, where there's no Kiddushin, even according to those that say there is Kiddushin, as long as there's no Nisuin, the real fear, the real difficulty involves in really getting into the marriage consummation, which is Biyah, and supporting a household. That burden is what the real issue is. So that burden is postponed until she gets older. As long as that's postponed, the young girl will not be affected by the fact that she is anticipating the marriage that is upcoming or that she will marry this individual later on. Amar Rav Huna, Bagra Yom Echad V'Nitkatsha. She reaches the age of Bogeret for one day, V'Nitkatsha, and then she gets engaged, halachically. Nodim La Shloshim Yom Ke'almana. She only gets 30 days like an almana. The basic logic behind Rav Huna's position is that a Bogeret is a woman who's been waiting to get married for a very long time. She is past her prime already. And therefore, when she's reached the Bogeret, she obviously has got together all of her jewelry and everything that's ready, because she's just waiting to get married at this point in time. And since she's waiting to get married, she surely did the preparation so that she can enter into the marriage. Meitavei, is that really true? Bagra, harihi kitvua. A girl who reaches the age of Bogeret, she is the same as someone whose hand has been asked in marriage. My love, kitvua de betula. That's like someone who was asked like a betula in the next 12 months. Lo, kitzvua, almana. That one was easy to answer. No, it's like asking the hand of marriage of an almana, where there's only a 30-day window. Tashma, bogeret, sheshata, 12 chodesh. A bogeret that waited 12 months. Rabbi Lezer Omer, ho v'chayav bala b'mezonotea. Since her husband is responsible for a mezonot, yafer, he has the right to nullify her nidarim. So over here, again, this is according to the Mishnah Rishona. The Mishnah Rishonah, when you cross over the threshold of 12 months and he is obligated in the Mizunot, since he's obligated in the Mizunot, he also gets the right of Hafarah. He gets the right to nullify because the woman is definitely taking an Aldat Bala. Now, truth is, from the time of Erusin, the husband does have a right, or veto right. The father and the husband share that veto right for an Arusa. So over here, when he says, Chaya Bala Mizunotah Yafer, seemingly what he means over here is Yafer Levad, that he's able to do it alone at this point in time, because he's now, in a sense, taking responsibility more than just the Erusin. He's also supporting her at this point in time. And because of that, she's really left the auspices of her father in an effective sense, even though there is no Nisuin over here. Ema, so the Gemara amends that to say, Bogeret, Vishishata Shnema Zarchodet. Whether she's a Bogeret, or she's waited 12 months, Rebelez Omer, O Bala Chayab Mizanotea, Yafer. Bogeret after 30 days, and the woman who waited 12 months, there where the husband now becomes obligated. In that case, Rabbi Elazar says that he's granted the right of hafara without the shutfut of the father. Tashma, hame'ares et ha-betula. A person who gets engaged to a betula. Ben shetava abal, v'hi me'akevet. Whether it is that the husband has asked her, and she is causing the delay, or whether she asks for the hand of marriage and the husband is causing the delay, we live for a 12-month period from the time of the tviyah, of alo mishat erusin, but not from the time of erusin. This makes very clear what I said in the Mishnah, that these are two different times. The tviyah and the erusin are not synonymous over here. We don't count from the time of erusin. We count from the time of tviyah. But what seems here is that either one of them can drive this process. Meaning that the husband can say, 12 months to Nisuin, he can start the clock, or the woman can start the clock. That's what this Braita suggests over here, which is, Ben Shetava Baal V'hi Me'akevet. The husband wants to go ahead, and she says, no, I'm not ready. Or whether she says, I'm ready to go ahead, and the husband says, I'm not ready, then the clock starts. From then, the 12-month clock starts from that point in time. Now, if they agree to do it in less time, that's fine. The standard is 12 months, and neither party can stop the clock. But the clock doesn't start from Erusin, it starts from the point in time when they agree, or one party at least, call it, sues for marriage. If one party says that I'm ready, then that starts the clock. Ubagra, harihi, kitvua. And a bogeret has the same status as someone who has had their hand asked in marriage. Ketzad, what's the case? Bagra yom echad, v'nitkatsha. If she now is one day over the age of Bogeret and gets engaged to Lachni, notnim la 12 chodesh. She gets 12 months. And someone is engaged gets 30 days. All right, so now, first of all, tiyufta de Rav Yehuna tiyufta. It's very clear here that this braita says the exact opposite of what Rav Yehuna says, which is when she's a bogeret yom echad, one day over bogeret, she gets a full 12 months, not like what Rav Yehuna says that she gets 30 days. So that's the first din that we have over here. So the Rav Yehuna, we have a very strong question that undermines his position. That's number one. Number two is, what is this last line of the braita? The braita says, arusa shloshim yom. Who is this arusa that gets 30 days? Mai uvarusa shloshim yom. What does it mean that arusa gets 30 days? Arusa has nothing to do with the problem here. It's whether she's a tular or an almanah. That's the question at hand. It's not a question whether she's an arusa or not. Samra papa achi kamar. This is what it means. Bogeret shavru aleh 12 chodesh bebagrut. If a girl has passed 12 months while she is a bogeret, benid katsha, and then she has kiddushin, nodim la shloshim yom ke almanah. Then she gets 30 days like an almanah. So this is really a modification of Rav Huna's statement, which is Rav Huna is not completely wrong. What he's wrong about is when that starts. He says that the day after she turns into Bulgaret, then she only gets 30 days. The Gemara says no. What the Braita says is, yes, there is a point in time where a Bulgaret gets 30 days. That's after she's 12 months past her time of being a Bulgaret. She's in a sense, from the moment she turns into a Bulgaret, we consider that as if the moment of her hand being asked to marriage has started. And therefore, over the next 12 months, she clearly prepares, because again, she's just a woman in waiting. Therefore, if her hand is asked to marriage after that 12-month period, she gets 30 days like an almanah, which is when the girl reaches 13 and a half. At that point in time, she has the same status as an almanah, which is that at 13 and a half, she only gets 30 days after that point in time, because she obviously had sufficient time to prepare. The question that does come up here is, what happens if she's already 6 months into being a bogeret? If she's already 6 months into being a bogeret and then somebody asks for her hand in marriage, does she then get a full 12 months? Or does she get the residual 6 months that would have taken her until the point in time when she's finished with her bagrut and then the 30 days after that? So she'll get 7 months technically in that case. Tosafot and Rashi over here both say the bagrut 12 months out, that is the maximum amount that she's going to get. Therefore, if she gets engaged sometimes after the time that she's a bogeret, but before the 12 months have elapsed, she will get the residual time that she would have been entitled to as a bogeret, but she won't get a full new 12 months from that period of time. There are other Rishonim who argue, if she's still within that 12-month window, if the Kiddushin take place prior to her crossing over the 12 months after her bagrut, she gets a full 12 months. She gets 12 months, no matter what, until she crosses over 12 months after her bagrutah. So if she's 6 months into her bagrut, she gets another 12 months at that point in time because she hasn't crossed over the point where she becomes like an almanah. Higi hazman v'lo niso. If time comes and he does not marry her, he does not consummate the marriage. Amar ula, dvar Torah, arusa bat Yisrael ochele b'truma. This is what we discussed before. That mina Torah and arusa is entitled to truma. Shenemar b'kohen ki ikneg nefesh kinyan kaspo. That a kohen, when he acquires someone that is his possession, b'hainami kinyan kaspo, and this woman is kinyan kaspo, because the kiddushin is done in a sense like a transaction, and therefore she has a status like kinyan kaspo. Mata mamru eino ochelet. So if that's the case, min haTorah, she's entitled to eat truma, then why is she not eating truma? What is the takanat chamim that prevented her from eating truma? Shema imazgula kos v'beit abia. Maybe they'll pour a glass of wine in her father's house. Now remember, a glass of wine is not like today, where it's once in a blue moon, people are drinking a glass of wine. Wine was the primary drink that was at every meal. And so there we're talking about, on a regular basis, she would be receiving wine and drinking wine. And her fear is that she's a very nice girl. She will share with her family. She's in her father's house still, because he has yet to take her. There's no chuppah, there's no biyah, there was no nisuin over here. She's still living with her father. Since she's living with her father, if we give her wine, she's going to share that with her family. Meantime, it's truma, and we don't want her sharing that with her family. Iochi, higi hazman velo niso nami. Even if it reached the threshold by the point where he didn't get married, also over there we should not grant her truma. So Gemara says, otam duchtam yachidah. Over there he segregates out a place for her and says, you'll eat over here. Whether that is near him, with his relatives, whatever it is, he takes care of it at that point. Elamiato, well, if that's the case, makit kohen li Yisrael. If you have a Kohen who works for Israel, a Sakhir Kohen that works for Israel, lo leichol truma, he should not bring his truma with him. Duma ato lemaichol ba'adei, because maybe he'll share it with his owner, with his master over here, the person who hired him. Gemara says, hashta mididu safule, mididei achle. Wait a minute. You're reversing the roles in the relationship over here. The Bala Bayit is obligated to provide mizonot for his workers. So he's the one giving mizonot, and all of a sudden the Kohen here is gonna give back to the owner. The roles are in such a manner that the Bala Bayit is the one giving over here or granting the mizonot. The worker is not the one who's gonna be giving food or sharing with his master. So therefore, we don't worry about it. By Lakit Kohen, we don't worry about it because their roles are well defined. Since the roles are well defined, we don't worry about the worker sharing with his owner, his master, or his employer. The Gemara doesn't ask. Tosfos says, what about the opposite case? In a case where you have a Kohen who hires a Yisrael. So the Kohen who hires the Yisrael, he's giving Truma, he eats Truma, maybe he'll share it with his worker who's there, who's not entitled to Truma because he's a Zachir, he's an employee, he's not Kinyan Kaspo, and he's not entitled to Truma. So Tosfos over there says, we don't worry about that. Lo cheshin and klal, because who's in control? The control is that, number one, the individual who's in control over here is the Kohen. In the case of the Kohen has Truma, and he's used to having Truma, and he works with Truma all the time, and he knows he can't just give Truma to anybody. So it's not something where he's all of a sudden surprised, he doesn't know how to work with Truma. He knows about Truma, that's number one. Number two is, Rav Tosafot points out, it is usual for the guest to bring a gift for the provider of the food. So what the chashash was that this worker, this lakit, will provide something. He'll come in and say he wants to ingratiate himself in the eyes of the employer, and therefore he brings something for the employer. So what do? You bring some food, you bring something nice. So we're worried about there, if he's a Kohen, he's going to bring truma to give to the Yisrael and share, or he'll share part of what he brought for himself with the owner. On the other hand, when it's the other way around, where it's the owner is the Kohen and the Yisrael, we don't worry about it, because the Kohen's not going to just share food willy-nilly with the employee. So again, because of that reason of, number one, ingratiating himself in the eyes of the owner. Number two is the positions where the individual is a worker and he has an employer over there. The nature of their positions makes it that he is more likely to share food with his owner. So in all those cases, we worry about it. The answer is, Kamash Mam, we don't worry about it because the nature of the relationship is that the owner or the employer has to provide food. And because it's a one-way street, which is he's providing food, we don't expect it to go back the other way, and we don't worry about it. Rav Shmuel Bar Yehuda Amar Mishom Simpon. And some say that the Gishabir Rav Shmuel Bar Yehuda says that the problem here is Simpon. As Rashi says over here, Simpon is Lashon Bitul. It's a nullification. And that is because he might find something wrong with this woman. If he finds something wrong with this woman, he's going to nullify the Kiddushin and say it's a Kiddushay Taut. Because we give him time to figure out, he had Kiddushin. Kiddushin is done with a little or very minimal investigation. Then from the point of Kiddushin to Nisuin, they do much more thorough investigation of the woman in that point in time. So now, that Simpon might come and cause us to have retroactively the Kiddushin were Kiddushay Ta'ut. It was a mistake. They will be nullified. And then, in the meantime, she ate Shuma all this time improperly because she wasn't really married, quote-unquote, to the Kohen. Rav says, Yochi nichnasa l'chupa v'lo nivala nami. What happens if he takes her into the chupa and doesn't have biyah with her, so the nisuin is not consummated, which means that there's still a possibility of nullification of the marriage? Why don't we say over there she can't eat Shuma? Rav says, Otam mivdok bodikla. Over there, he's going to check her out. He will not take her into Nisuin, into the Chuppah, until he's done a full check. How does he do a full check if he's not married to her, he's never had intimacy with her? Relatives. The relatives that see her at the mikveh will tell him what this woman looks like, how she is. Remember, in those days, the women that were nidot were going to the mikveh on a regular basis, not just after they got married, even beforehand because of the problems of Tumah. So his relatives had ample time to figure out what her story is. So therefore, you know, that's a mivdak badikla, v'hadar mayu, and then he'll bring her into the chuppah. Elamiata eved kohen shalachol miYisrael lo leichol b'truma mishum simpon. An eved that is purchased, an eved knani that was purchased from Israel, a kohen purchases eved knani from Israel. Also over there, we should worry about simpon. We should worry about the fact that it might be a mekach ta'ot, and this eved will go back to his original owner. Mar says, simpon v'avadim leka. There is no concept of simpon, of a nullification of the sale. Why? Diavrai, hakachazile. If it's an external problem, an obvious external issue, then he saw it. V'i digavai. And if it's more of an internal or a hidden problem, malocha kabai, shibiseta lo ichbatle. The fact that he has some sort of deformity on his chest or something like that makes no difference to him. This guy's here to work. He's not here for his beauty. He's not here for anything that has to do with intimacy. So therefore, it doesn't matter that there's something that was hidden that the Baal doesn't know about it. If it's something out in the open, he knows about it and he accepted it if he purchased him. If it's hidden, it doesn't matter. For a woman, both of those issues matter because the husband both is marrying this woman for their interacting on a normal basis, but also for intimacy. And therefore, if there's some sort of hidden deformity, that's also an issue. Over here, seemingly we're talking about physical deformities over here, not mental issues, which, again, are not so recognized by the Gemara in that time. Nimtza ganav o kuvyustus. If they find out after the fact that the Eved is a ganav, or according to Rashi, kuvyustus means he's a kidnapper. So this, they find out that this guy is involved in crime, that the Eved that he bought was very involved in crime. Higio, they got what he paid for. As Rashi says over here, Stam Avadim are ganavim. Stam Avadim are thieves. And that's what you expect. You should expect that when you buy an Eved Kanani, you're getting a thief. So whether it's a thief for money or a thief for people, kidnapper, you should expect that. And therefore, if that's what he finds out after the fact, that will not undermine the sale. And the sale is still a good sale because you should have expected that. Tosfot over here, Tosfot other places in Shas, argues on Rashi about the meaning of kuvyustus. Rashi always says it's a kidnapper. Tosafot says it's certainly not a kidnapper. He says it's a gambler. That it's got to be a gambler because a kuvyustus, a kidnapper, is much too significant and serious. And therefore, you can't say higio. And number two is it doesn't fit into other places in the Gemara, where seemingly a kuvyustus is not a serious infraction like a kidnapper. Therefore, Tosafot claims that we're speaking about a gambler over here. So if he's a thief or a gambler, you should have expected that. What are you going to do about the fact that he turns out to be an armed marauder or a muhtav machut, which is that he's done something where the king has decreed that this guy can be killed by anybody who finds him, they should kill him, and by the decree of the king? Hanu kala itluhu. Those are issues that are serious and they're well known. People know about these things. And since they have a kala, as Rashi says, the sover v'kabil. He accepted it. Whatever he did, he accepted because he knew about it. This information is well known. Tosafot, on the other hand, brings listim izuyain and muktav machut. The Gemara in Bava Basra seems to suggest that you can say harishal chav fanecha. You can just hand him back to the other guy and say, this is your guy, it's not my problem. You gotta take him back. So there, Rabbeinu Tam kala idluhu means v'lo shchiche. It's not a common thing. V'lo chashinu b'hu l'simpon came into lo shchiche. But Rabbeinu Tam says, shum kala idluhu is not, since they're so infrequent, when they do happen, it's a big public event because people don't know about it. Therefore, even if you don't know about it, there's no din of simpon over there because it's not shchiach. Therefore, the chachamim were not gozer simpon in those cases because they're very unusual cases. And even when they come up, they usually are well known. Therefore, if it happens to be that he ends up with an eved like that, it's really his issue. And tari shalcha lefanech, I mean, you gotta keep him, take him the way it is. On the other hand, he brings from the Rabbeinu Eliyahu that supports Rashi's understanding over there that the difference is where the money sits right now. The question is, who has the money? If the money is with the purchaser, then he could just hand the Eved back and say, Ashari Shalcha Lefanecha, and he can keep his money. On the other hand, if he's already paid for him, then he can't undo it because of our Gemara over here, Kala Itlo, and basically he got what he got, and he can't complain about it. So that's the way that the Rabbeinu Eliyahu resolves this stira according to Rashi Shita. Depends where the money is sitting right now. It's a Mosimi Chavre Olav Araya, and therefore whoever has the money is in control. If a person hasn't paid for it, he can hand him back. If he's already paid for it, then he's stuck. There being a time again explains, despite the fact that he can hand him back, we don't worry about simpon because it's just not a common case. Now the Gemara says Michte. Ben Lamar Ben Lamar Lo Achla. Whether you say the reason is simpon, whether you say the reason is that maybe she'll share with her family, they both say she can't eat. My benayu. What is the nafka min halacha between these reasons? Ike beinayu, kibel, masar valach. These three instances are the nafka minu between them. Kibel is a case where kibel alav baal et amumim, the simple. He accepts, he says, I'll take this woman no matter what she has. So in that case, we don't worry about simpon, but we still will worry about her giving to her relatives. So therefore, that case will still be there. The case of Masar is where the Av gives her over to the Shluchei Abal. The father gives her over to the Shluchei Abal. In that case, there's no longer an issue of her sharing with her family because she's not with her family anymore. She's on the way back to her husband's house. In terms of Simpon, that still exists because she has to get there and he hasn't investigated her yet. And the same will be with Halach. If the Shluchei Av accompanied the Shluchei Abal, in that case also, we don't worry about her sharing with the other people that are there. But we still worry about the case of Simpon. We worry about sharing, worry about her sharing with her family. We don't worry about her sharing with the Shluchim that accompany her with the Shluchei Abal, the Shluchei Av that accompany the Shluchei Av. Even though if you look back at Tosafot, back on Mem Ched Amud Bet, Tosafot over there does suggest that we do worry about that. He says over there that we do worry about the fact that the woman might be a really nice girl, and when she gets Truma, she'll share with the Shluchei Abal that we're sent with her because she's nice. She says, these people are accompanying me and taking care of me, and therefore I would worry about it. And therefore, Tosafot explains all the cases here as being cases where the Baal was Mikabel because there's a Gemar Kinyan. When there's a transference of the woman, that's enough to be a Gemar Kinyan and Nisu'in in effect, and therefore the Simpon is out of the picture. There's still the issue of Shema Tashkeh that she will give to drink, whether it's from her family, whether it's from the Shluchim. Either way, that risk still exists, and Tosafot explains it just the opposite of Rashi. That Tosafot also discusses the fact that this machloket about Simpon and Shema Tashkeh, maybe she will give over to her relatives, is only a machloket in the Mishnah Rishonah. But in the Mishnah Achronah, the only issue is Simpon over there, and that's the reasoning behind the Mishnah Achronah. Even though Rashi, back on Daf Mem Ched Amud Bet, argued that that same machloket with regards to Simpon and whether she'll share with her relatives applies to even the Mishnah Achronah, not just to the Mishnah Rishonah. So you have a machloket as to whether these reasons are still valid in the Mishnah Achronah, or does everybody agree in the Mishnah Achronah that the reasoning is the Simpon. Okay, we're going to stop over here by the two dots on the top of Nunchet Amud Aleph.